Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Mike Reeser, and he'll be answering your most important questions on Magdalena Bay, Baja's hidden secret. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Mike a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to ask your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. The broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Mike Reeser about Magdalena Bay, Baja's hidden secret. When you stay at Tarpon Key Lodge in Belize, you are only a step away from fly fishing for tarpon, permit, and bonefish. In fact, you may see permit tailing right off the deck of your cabana. At Tarpon Key Lodge, you can fish the tides, not the clock, and that makes all the difference in the world. You can fish the lagoon for tarpon or the flats for permit and bonefish. It's your choice. Tarpon Key Lodge is located on a private island just 30 minutes from Placentia. You can fish with world-class guides like Charlie Leslie Sr., or make it a do-it-yourself trip and take one of the kayaks out and spend the day alone. If you're looking for that grand slam, Tarpon Key Lodge in Belize is the place to go. Book your next adventure now. Visit www.tarponkey.com. That's tarponkey.com. Before we introduce Mike, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we're giving away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the International Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered for the drawing yet, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Mike's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Mike's book, Fly Fishing Baja and Beyond. So here's how you can win Mike's book. You have to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question is going to be something that Mike and I talk about during the show. So you must keep your ears open, take good notes, and at the end, submit your answer along with your name and your location in the text box on our homepage. It's the same place that you can ask questions during the show. So put your answer in there, and you may be the lucky winner of Mike's book, Fly Fishing Baja and Beyond. Our guest tonight is Captain Mike Reeser. Mike got the fly fishing bug at the impressionable age of 10. Keen interest in fly tying quickly followed with raids on his mother's sewing kit and the gathering of feathers and fur from the reluctant barnyard critters. A driver's license and a car in 1967 carried Mike's fly fishing passion from the local rivers and ponds to the Pacific Ocean in pursuit of bonito, calico bass, stripers, and blue shark. In 1973, Mike made his first trip down the Baja, where he would spend the next 15 winters camping on the beaches and fishing flies in his new fly fishing frontier. A great deal of time was spent camping and fishing with the hand-line fishermen, the Panjeros, who, despite their skepticism about fishing the wimpy rod, shared their knowledge of the Sea of Cortez and its great variety of fish. Through trial and error and the methods evolved to catch many species, such as rooster fish, once deemed to be impossible on the fly. This foundation of knowledge and experience would eventually lead him to establish the Baja Fly Fishing Company in 1997. Always innovative, Mike has developed tactic and fly patterns effective on a wide variety of species that swim the Sea of Cortez. Mike and the other guides at Baja Fly Fishing spend considerable time in the pursuit of rooster fish, with many large specimens landed by the Baja Fly Fishing clients each year. Besides guiding on Baja, Mike has worked as a fly fishing guide since 1974 in the Sierra Nevadas and the Rocky Mountains. He ties flies commercially and worked as a saltwater fly fishing advisor for the Fly Fishing Destination television show. The Baja Fly Fishing Company has also been featured in Warren Miller Productions, Ron and Raven Show, Fly Fishing Across America, Michael Falk's production, Seasons on the Fly, and Anglers West. And Mike has also written several magazine articles and published his book, Fly Fishing Baja and Beyond. Hey, Mike, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks, Roger. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, great to have you back. Before we dive into the questions, I need to apologize for not having a show. The last time we were having a show, I set out a lengthy explanation. I actually was riding in an ambulance at the time of the show. So long story short, I was coming in the house to do the show, slipped on the ice in front of my house, and in essence couldn't move, and had to get the 911 to come and get me. Anyway, turned out to be just a big back sprain, no broken bones, no injured organs, and I'm kind of pretty much about 90% back in action. Let's put it this way, I was out shoveling snow today, so I'm just about 100%. So, but it was a scary thing where I live up in the mountains. If I couldn't have gotten into the house to get to the phone, I could have laid out there all night, and there wouldn't have been a show tonight probably. So kind of a scary deal, but thanks to all of you who sent in your kind messages and well wishes. I really appreciate that. It was nice to see all those when I got back to a computer, so I appreciate all that. So with that said, on, and we're back in the saddle and raring to go here. So, Mike, let's start with Baja in general, because I think, you know, and you guide in several areas, so I want to kind of have you give an overall description of where people tend to fish and the areas that you specialize in and why, from a general nature. And then we'll dive in to the specifics, because we did do a show on the rooster fish, which I want you to talk about that area that you're famous for as well. But give us an overall rundown of Baja and where people usually go fishing.
Okay. Well, you know, the part of the why is I don't have to worry about slipping on the ice walking around my house. Baja. So, yeah, that's part of the why. You know, you read my bio out, and I did. I went to the Baja in 1974, absolutely fell in love with the it's an incredibly diverse fishery from the north of the Sea of Cortez all the way down, including, and then also, too, the Pacific Ocean starting up around Ensenada down. Both sides start out as fairly cold, temperate oceans, and gradually, as you move 1,000 miles south, the oceans warm too. You really get into tropical, semi-tropical conditions in the bottom, say, quarter to third of the Baja Peninsula. Variety is really the name of the game here, and we have to date caught probably 40 different species on fly. In fact, I know one of our trips in August this year, the clients fished 5 days, and they caught 32 species. And Rex, if you're out there listening tonight, which I think you are, you guys still hold the record for 32 species in a single outing. So definitely variety. And one of the things that the Sea of Cortez offers is that it drops off deep fairly fast. And so you can fish inshore species and blue water species on the Sea of Cortez side. And as, of course, as you move further south, you get into all of the varieties of the blue water pelagics, the dorado, tuna, wahoo, striped marlin, sailfish. This year we did actually quite well on blue marlin on the fly. We got a run of smaller blues that we could actually handle on the fly gear. And, of course, inshore, the rooster fish is without a doubt one of the most challenging fish that you can catch on fly, or in many cases be absolutely frustrated in the process of trying to get them to eat an artificial.
Still there, Mike?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. It went so silent, I thought you would
I ran out of air there, so
you ran out of air. So that's the Sea of Cortez side, and that's somewhat protected because of the Baja Peninsula from, you know, the larger Pacific Ocean, right? So you're not getting that heavy seas coming in there, I would think.
Is no, very flat.
Yeah.
Very flat
yeah.
waters, unless you actually have a storm, and then it can get churned up. But on a day-to-day average basis, it is so much flatter on the Sea of Cortez. It's like a big lake. It would be like fishing Lake Michigan.
So I assume as you round the tip of the Baja Peninsula, then the seas start churning up, and you get into the Pacific Ocean type of fishing that you see up and down the
Very
coast.
Very definitely, and it's one of the advantages. Our base of operation is located in what they call the East Cape, and it's roughly halfway between the town of Cabo San Lucas and the town of La Paz. So it's a very protected area in there. It offers the opportunity to get out on blue water without the swell and that. And then, of course, on beaches, we have the opportunity to sight fish for rooster fish in 3 to 4 feet of water. And literally those fish follow the wave trough line that's 20 feet off dry sand in their search primarily for mullet, but also other large prey species. They love to eat the ladyfish and the green shacks and the caballito. And this year we had the threadfin herring that we hadn't seen before. That's a Central American bait fish, and they were in abundance this year. But those roosters come right along the shoreline there, and you can see them position and cast to them, whereas the Pacific side's a bit more of a challenge because of the big surf and a very steep drop-off on the beaches.
Yeah, yeah. But then as you move up the coast to the area we're going to talk about today, Magdalena Bay, that then creates three different fisheries, right, in that area? Because you've got some protection there.
The area that is referred to as Magdalena Bay is an incredible fishery. It's one that I was introduced to back in the 70s, and because of access and all into there is very difficult. It really wasn't until the early 2000s that I got back there and started to look at the opportunities that present in there. But essentially, it is very different from the rest of the Pacific coastline. It is an area approximately 150 miles north and to south. You have a series of long, narrow barrier islands, something like, think about the South Padre and that on the Texas coastline and the barrier islands off the Carolinas, that there are a series there, and what they form on the inside is a series of bays and a connecting channel that connects all the bays. Magdalena Bay is actually the largest bay, but to the south you have Almejas, and you get down into Cancun, Puerto Chale, Santa Fe, and then north you come up into La Florida, Soledad, Santo Domingo. Those are all smaller bays than Magdalena. But then coming off of that, you have hundreds of islands and channel, and the majority of it is lined in mangrove. You can really get lost in the intricacies and the expanse of all these channels and islands, mangrove-lined, so it creates a tremendous amount of habitat and is the nursery for so many species, from the small prey species up to the largest predator species that are hatched, born in that area. They grow up to a certain size in the protection of the mangrove and in the abundant food source there, and then go out into the broader Pacific. So when we talk about Magdalena Bay, it's really kind of the center of this whole complex of bays. And we actually work out of the town of Lopez Mateos, which is about 35 miles north of the town of San Carlos on Magdalena Bay. So we're fishing primarily north of Magdalena Bay proper.
Okay, so I'm looking at Google Earth down there right now. If folks are on their computer, if you go to maps.google.com and then search for Baja, Mexico, switch over to the Earth map, you can kind of get a good picture of that. So what I'm seeing there, Mike, is a lot of channels and stuff going all up the coast from the major bay all the way up to Lopez Mateos, right?
Exactly. And then from Lopez Mateos, you go approximately, well, about 3 miles, and you hit Boca de Soledad, which is an entrance between the islands that accesses you to the Pacific. Another 18 miles is another mouth, or what they call a boca.
I see. And that's I see both of those, yeah.
That's Santo Domingo. And when we're fishing the mangrove, we primarily work between the town of Lopez Mateos up to the mouth at Santo Domingo. And then we go about 18 miles south of there, what they call Curva de Diablo. And so we're roughly working 18 north, 18 south out of the center point at Lopez Mateos, just kind of depending on fish availability. Sometimes tides and moon will enter into it, and what water is a little more settled and easier to work based on the tidal changes. But that is kind of our primary focus area, and I fished all over the whole complex of islands from north to south, and we have found that the area north and south of Lopez Mateos probably has the greatest number of fish and the greatest variety of species in that area, plus a very close access to jump out and get into the Pacific. And then you've got the inshore reefs. You've got kind of a middle area where you start to getting into your pelagics on some of the first drop-offs, and then eventually getting out to the major banks that are on the Pacific Ridge, and that would include like the Thetis, the 23 fathom, the 28 fathom, which is without a doubt one of the greatest areas in the world, really, for striped marlin. People pretty much overlook the big numbers of Dorado out there, but they are there. And then the potential to catch wahoo is very, very high off of both the Thetis, the 23, and the 28-fathom banks. Hmm. Can't forget the elephant tuna either.
And how far out is that, miles-wise?
It is from the dock, it's about 28 miles out to the Thetis proper. Now, there's some years we never even get to the Thetis. We start picking up Dorado at about 6 miles out of the mouth. In fact, last fall, our clients, we only made a couple trips to the Thetis. We were hitting so many Dorado between 6 and 7 miles, some days running 12. But the Thetis proper for us is about a two-hour run. But we're closer to the Thetis than, say, out of Magdalena Bay itself. If you leave out of San Carlos, you've got to run south to just get out of Magdalena Bay, which is a big bay. We're talking on par with the Bay of La Paz. So you got to run south a ways before you can turn at the mouth and then turn and go north. So they've got quite a bit further haul to get out to the banks, whereas we can do it in a little under 2 hours from where we are, have a good day on the banks, and then come back to the hotel at night. We don't base out overnight on the banks, although some of the other boats working out of San Carlos do.
Now, the actual larger Magdalena Bay, does that offer any different kind of fishing than the smaller bays that you're fishing up north?
It's mostly they do out of San Carlos itself. Is the larger bay has fishing in it, but they do like we do. They jump up into the smaller canals, and not smaller. I mean, some of these canals, these channels, are places over a mile wide. They're more like small bays in of themselves. And most of the boats out of San Carlos will run back up towards Curva de Diablo and some of the areas that we hit coming from the north. But they're moving more back into the more constricted water flow areas of the main channel and then those channels that come into the main channel from the inland side.
Okay. And like I said, we're going to dig deep in each one of these areas. But if a person's coming down there and you actually you put your people up in Lopez Mateos, right?
That's correct. You know, up until a few years ago, it was a very little known area from the land base. Now, the Thetis banks offshore have been very, very popular with the long-range boats running out of San Diego for many, many years. But as far as the land base operation, the area out of Lopez Mateo is really just been kind of discovered by more people here in recent years. And until the whale watching phenomena kind of came along, it's now become a very, very popular place for whales in the wintertime. There wasn't a lot in the way of facilities in town. The hotels, by and large, closed down once whale season was over and left just a few choices in town. Since then, the Mangrove Inn has been built. It's been up now for 2 years. It offers six spacious bungalows out of town on its own little side channel, and the rooms are very nice, air-conditioned now. At least half of them are air-conditioned, and I think the rest will be air-conditioned by this summer. And great food. And unless the water is really skinny on low tides, most days the boats pick us up right in front of the hotel. So we now have good accommodations for folks to go along with the good fishing.
Okay. Well, we have we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk more about the Magdalena Bay area. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as an unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft could be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I have ever tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kick boats, I'm convinced that the Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing." Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to www.bigskyinflatables.com. That's bigskyinflatables.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Mike Reeser about Magdalena Bay area. If you'd like to ask Mike a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Mike, tell us a bit. You've already mentioned your guide business, but you run a full-fledged guide service down there in both on the Sea of Cortez side as well as the Magdalena Bay area, right? And do you operate anywhere else, or are those the two places that you do?
Those are the two primary places. East Cape, which is still our headquarters, and we live most of the year on the East Cape, and then Magdalena Bay. I am starting to run a few beach trips over north and south of Topo dos Santos, and we're going to continue to kind of explore the potential over there. There's times that can get really hot in the surf. But, no, primarily East Cape and Magdalena Bay. And down on the East Cape, we can offer the Van Warmer Hotels of Palmas de Cortez, Playa del Sol, the VS. We're affiliated with Spa Buenavista, Rancho Leonero, and actually Rancho Buenavista did open this year. So we're kind of open on a limited basis, and we offer lodging at Rancho Buenavista, which is actually the oldest of all of the fishing hotels on the Baja. We also have options for people to stay in private homes, either VRBOs, room rentals in larger houses, casitas in the back, a lot of options there. One of the things about the East Cape is we can run, you know, the beach fishing for roosters. It's probably some of the best opportunity in the world to find roosters enclosed and available to a fly fisherman sight fishing standing on dry ground, as well
right.
as, you know, at La Ribera, you know, it's less than a 2-mile run, and we're on the La Ribera banks, and you're over billfish and dorado and the pelagics.
Mm-hmm. Now, you'd mentioned you're exploring Todos Santos, which is on the Pacific side.
Todos Santos is about 45, 50 miles north of Cabo San Lucas. And there's some beaches south of there and going north that we're starting to explore. We haul a UTV up there, four-seater, and we can run many, many miles up and down the Pacific side. And we have literally caught dorado out of the surf at times. It can be very good for roosters. It's a challenging fishery just because of the big Pacific surf that
right.
we encounter there. But it's another option. But definitely,
yeah.
I think in terms of a fishery and opportunity, the area that we kind of refer to as Magdalena Bay, but out of Lopez Mateos, really, in this day and age of worldwide declining fisheries, it still offers an incredible fishing experience.
Yeah. Let's dig into that a little bit more. We did have some questions generally, and I want to address those before we get into the specific areas. Doug up in Calgary, Alberta, he says he wants to know, is fishing available year-round, or are there seasonal aspects of the fishing?
The Magdalena complex is definitely seasonal, whereas, like, say, down on the Sea of Cortez side, the East Cape is a much, much longer season. We get a water change that happens about the end of March on that part of the Pacific, where we'll see a good 10 to 12 degree temperature plunge that lasts into May. And I mean, the water will drop into the low 60s, maybe in the high 50s. So it pretty much precludes your offshore blue water species. Now, the inshore fishing inside the mangrove stays still fairly good. The corvinas are in there. The smaller broomtail groupers and jacks and all are found in there, but what we refer to as Magdalena Bay in that area starts really turning on late June and July as the water temperature is warm. And what happens, the fish really push that temperature change as it goes north, right on that cusp between water that they're really comfortable in and colder water. Generally, you get a lot of nutrient trapped in that temperature differential, and those fish follow that north. And as we saw here in this last El Nino event, those fish followed it well up into Southern California waters. But in a normal year, they were.
That's what I heard, some strange stories.
We had decent fishing, but we didn't see the huge concentrations. Those fish were scattered all up and down the Baja. In more normal conditions, those fish will be concentrated around us late June into July. We'll get into some good dorado fishing at that time. I'd say good billfish fishing, not epic like in the fall, but a chance during that water temperature change that you can get in some big Sierra mackerel offshore, some yellowfin tuna. This year in July, we got into yellowtail. I mean, one fish on would be a yellowfin. The next would be a yellowtail. The next might be a dorado. July is the time that roosters sometimes show up along our beaches out of Lopez Mateos. And certainly we're into the big corvina, into broomtail grouper, all types of pargos, oh, gosh, so many different species. We do get bonefish at that time of year.
Now, pardon?
Go ahead, Roger.
Yeah, there was a question about from Doug as well about where to stay, and you're saying Lopez Mateos up north. But do people, because I'm going to ask you about some do-it-yourself options here as well, is Puerto San Carlos another option as a place to stay if you're trying to fish that area?
It is. There's probably actually more hotels and all out of San Carlos and a number of outfitters that fish the Magdalena Bay area. I would say for the most part they're coming up into the waters that we kind of overlapped a lot of the mangrove fishing. And then we're quite a bit closer to the blue water side.
Blue water.
But that's a large port city, and there are a lot of, probably more, you know, hotel operations in there. In terms of Doug's question as a do-it-yourselfer area, this is not an easy do-it-yourself area. The East Cape is much, much easier for a do-it-yourselfer because of access to the water. What makes this area so good is the mangrove. It also makes it very difficult to get to the water's edge in a lot of areas. In fact, where the mangrove kind of thins out and you can actually get to the water, you're up in some fairly skinny mud flats. There are some opportunities north of and south of Lopez Mateos that you can drive to areas that you can actually get down to the water. El Rojo, which is an old cement plant and dock facility, there's some areas in there that you can actually drive to and cover some shoreline. But if someone is coming down as a do-it-yourselfer, they're much better off if they have a small boat that they can haul with them. And then there's a lot of opportunities. This is, by and large, not a difficult fishery, like, say, going off on your own after roosterfish. There's a pretty good learning curve on roosterfish, but they're very accessible on your own. This is a fishery that if you can get to them, then it does lend itself well as a do-it-yourself fishery.
Okay, yeah, we had two questions from Ari and Bernard in Los Angeles, both asking about launch facilities and, you know, points of access. So are there, you had mentioned the cement plant, but are there any official launch areas, or is it?
Actually, a very good launch facility right in the town of Lopez Mateos. There is a concrete apron that you can launch off of. There is a dock, a big cement, really pier that is right there. And if the cement apron is busy, it's real hard packed mud that you can back into with the trailer with no problem at all. So if you have a boat, there's a lot of opportunities. One of the other things that
Before you go on, any problem getting a boat down there, bringing it across the border or anything?
No. As long as when you cross the border, I've found that as long as the boat is legally registered in the United States, the customs inspection at the border is pretty perfunctory. Some border crossings are easier than others. We like to cross at Algodones, just outside of Yuma. And any of those listeners that are, you know, from Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and the, you know, Central Rocky region, that puts you closer than, say, swinging all the way around to the California side. But my experience has been pretty positive coming across as long as the boat has currently registered in the state that you're coming from. There's not a problem bringing it down. The roads are so much better than they used to be. Wider shoulders. The area right around Caravina is really about the only place that's kind of got old pavement and potholes. Now, they're continually upgrading the road, so there are times that you'll hit some construction areas that when you're pulling a boat, you know, you're going to have to go slow through those construction areas. Right. But otherwise, no, there's a lot of people that haul boats down. And especially, you know, inside the mangrove, you don't need a large boat. We seldom get, it is so protected in the mangrove, even when we have windy conditions, that if you've got something even in the 14-foot range, you're going to be able to fish most days. But, you know, 16, 18-footer, shouldn't have any problem at all.
Okay, good. Good. A couple questions from Phil and Joe. Joe's down in Richmond, Texas. Phil is in Kentucky. About safety, you know, any comments about avoiding being a victim of crime down there? Or is that any kind of an issue?
No, it is not. I have been traveling the Baja since 74, and I still drive the road quite a bit. back and forth. I enjoy the drive. I have really not seen any difference, in the drive. Tijuana has some bad neighborhoods, but then again, I can think of an awful lot of cities in the United States that scare the hell out of me. I wouldn't go into. You cross the border, you essentially are jumping, at Tijuana, you're essentially jumping on a four-lane toll road. Once you get on the Baja itself, the chance of encountering something is minuscule compared to close to where I'd stay in Colorado off East Colfax. Yeah, I'll take
the Baja. Okay, good. And another question in these tumultuous political times, Matt asks, from Fort Collins, what do you think the backlash will be towards gringos who come out to Mexico to fish or, for that matter, do anything over the next 4 years? So
when I was down there and the night of the election, the next day, people were going, are you all right, Mike? Are you all right? And my pardon to those that supported the other side. No. One thing that I found, and I've been a permanent resident of Mexico since 2006, and I visit the United States for a few months out of the year, is that really they're very pragmatic on things, and everything that I've heard politically down there as far as the Mexican government is that they want to work with the new administration, and they are not going to do something in Mexico that I think would hurt their economy. They have a vibrant economy, especially in the Baja. The state of Southern Baja actually has the highest average per capita earnings of anywhere in Mexico, and a lot of that is due to tourism. And it's the same thing, the safety question. There was a lot of concern with the cartels, early in 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, 2012. The cartels in and of themselves do not want to engage in anything with tourists. Where they have certain protections and all, where they've paid off officials, they lose that if it involves a foreigner. There's too much to lose on that. So as foreigners, you really are safe traveling in the country. If you're a victim of crime, it'll be the type of thing of leaving something out and, quick fingers. But
The
boss is not prone to that. I've found more problems over on the other coast than I ever found in the Baja. The people there they have a good living. The economy is good. They're very supportive of tourism. They're very friendly, very honest people. It's one of the reasons I enjoy living in Mexico is because of the culture and the high moral sense that these people have.
Yeah. It's interesting. You said, you were down there during the election. I was down in Belize the night of the election. And I'm talking to the guides down there, and I said, what do you think of this whole thing going on in America? And they go, well, we don't really care. It says, as long as you guys don't get a cold, because when you guys get a cold, we get pneumonia down here. They're talking about the economy. So they don't really care who's president as long as the economy is good, because that affects them directly, And
It does.
And Baja does too, Yeah.
Economy in the U.S. down. There's less money that people have available to spend, and there's fewer people to take vacations, The people are very, very worldly aware and accordingly, but I don't see a blowback. And I'm fairly well tied in with the politicians in the area. I know a couple of the congressmen, the senator for Southern Baja, and the governor, so they're all pretty positive.
Yeah. So more questions about do-it-yourself. Doug up in Calgary also said, is there any do-it-yourself from beaches or shore? So can you take a – I mean, is there – and there was another question I know, too, here about surf fishing.
Yeah.
If you get out
– There is an option. there is an option to do that, and it's something that I work with a family that is just, they're just incredible, of some of these options of taking people. It still involves a boat to
right.
get to the shoreline to fish, of taking people, dropping them off on the beach, and then coming back for them, like, say, in the afternoon. There's the option, too, of taking, you know, a couple of days' worth of food, a camp, and all that, and dropping off there. And there's a couple of outfitters. Gary Beulah does a really good job down there, and he uses the services of some of the pongueros with his clients, and they take people out onto those barrier sand islands, and they set up a camp, and then they can either paddle kayaks back into the mangrove channels, or they can walk over to the Pacific side. I mean, that island is not more than half a mile wide, in some places even a bit less. So there are the opportunities. It is just, it's not the type of thing that you can park your car, walk down to the beach and fish.
Right.
It involves boat transport to get you over there. And we can arrange that sort of thing for folks. I don't try to make any money off of that. I'm always happy to help people out and get them, you know, situated so they can give us a call and we can set them up with people that, you know, could take them out there and fish on their own.
So there is some camping available out there. Is there camping available at Lopez Mateos?
There is.
Campgrounds
basically, the shoreline of Mexico is all public land, and there are road accesses that can get you down along the shoreline. Like I said earlier, the biggest problem in that whole complex is that so much of the actual waterline is
mangrove.
Heavy mangrove. The game there, the kids will crawl up on top of the mangrove and literally swim over the, you know, staying in the treetops as far as they possibly can go before they drop down, you know, the ground. They'll climb back up again. It is thick. It is thick in a lot of places.
Well, I remember the last time, which is a long time ago, that I drove down Baja. It was in a VW Bug. It was 1975. And I spent 3 weeks down there just living on the beach. I think I stayed in a motel twice.
Right.
But
you're talking
no problem.
Experience.
and just lived off of clams and scallops and spearfishing and talking the shrimp boat guys to come in, give me some shrimp. And I had no problem camping almost anywhere. It was really like kind of.
No, there's
changed
there's,
since then.
You know, it really hasn't changed much at all. You know, like I said, I drive it 2-3 times a year. In certain years, and all up and down the Silla Cortez side, there's so many places to camp. The area between Murge and Loreto is the Bahia de Concepcion. It's got some great options. You can drive over to San Bruno. There's a lot of places that offer that. And the Pacific side, there are places too, and I tell you, an area that I think has got some great fishing in it is at Abreojos and the Estero Coyote at Campo René. It's a very, very small piece of mangrove estuary area, but oh my gosh, the amount of fish in there. This is an area 5 years ago that the commercial cooperative decided to ban gill netting inside the mangrove channels.
Mm-hmm.
And to just let that be as the nursery and concentrate on ecotourism and recreational fishing. And it was amazing how fast that fishery recovered. And the benefit to the commercial fishermen is that all of that broomtail grouper and the different types of pargos and snappers that grow up in the mangrove now swim out in the ocean and keep those offshore reefs well-stocked. They've got a sustainable fishery, and the way they fish offshore is primarily hook and line, to where that you don't get the bycatch. It's very focused on certain species. They are icing their catch and selling directly to the restaurants. It doesn't go through fish wholesalers. So what we're seeing is change from netting, gill netting, which is terribly indiscriminate.
Yeah.
And to a very selective harvest, and they're actually making more money doing it that way. They're better livelihood, and it's sustainable. We've seen a big improvement in the fishery in that area. But that's an area that is very good for somebody to come down on their
where
own.
Is that from, where is that from Lopez Mateos?
Abre Ojos is about 60 miles south of the town of Guerrero Negro, which is right on the border between northern Baja and southern Baja. It's a good 100, 120 miles north of where we are. Like I said, our situation
is... Oh, I see
is,
it up there, yeah. I see it, yeah.
Yeah. It's something that if somebody's driving down, if they want to do just a great adventure, driving down from the States, I heartily recommend that they find Abre Ojos on the map and Campo René, nice facilities there. And that's a great place for people that are do-it-yourselfers. And then you bounce back over to the Sia Cortez side, Santa Rosalia,
right.
Down to Mulegé and that. And you can work your way on down.
Right.
Our area, yeah. Like I said, just so hard to get to open water. It takes a while to figure out where those places are, and you still need some sort of watercraft, whether it be kayak or a car top or small boat that you haul with you.
Right. Well, let's focus on let's take a quick break here, and then we'll come right back and focus on the mangroves here in the next segment. So we'll be right back. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. And we're talking with Mike Reeser about Magdalena Bay, Baja's hidden secret. If you'd like to ask Mike a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Let me check real quick here. Yep, we covered safety aspect, covered do-it-yourself. I'm just checking these that have come in. We're going to cover that next. It says, I don't even know what this is, unfortunately. It says, how do you best deal with mordida situations?
Oh, mordida is, that's a bribe.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. There has been in the past a certain parts of the Baja, you're liable to get pulled over like a Georgia speed trap. One of the things that has happened in Mexico is that they're really cracking down on this sort of behavior, and cops that pull you over and then try to, you know, extort money out of you, if they're turned in to what they call the sindicatura, can be in big trouble. Every 2 years, these guys now go through a lie detector test, and if there's anything on their record that indicates that they're involved in fraudulent behavior, they are terminated.
Wow, that's really good to hear.
That activity has slowed down quite a bit. The town of Constitucion in close to our area used to be horrible for it. Fortunately, that is more and more a thing of the past. If you get pulled over and you feel that, you know, it's a bogus type of thing, you know, you went through a stop sign that you never saw because either the stop sign is down or it's carefully camouflaged or something like that, if you're respectful in that, sometimes you can talk the ticket down to a reasonable amount. And I tell you what, if that officer walks up to your car, does not have their badge on, or does not have their name tag on, they are operating in an illegal fashion. They have no authority without proper identification. and you can carefully point that out to them, and quite often they'll back away. It's not the situation it used to be, and I mean it used to be. Oh my God, back in the 70s and 80s.
Right. I remember at border crossings, waiting for the inspection, and waiting. And then finally, pulling out a $20 bill, and inspection is done.
It used to be particularly bad. The Baja was never bad because you could always drive a vehicle down without car papers on the Baja. It's a free trade zone, whereas if you cross at Nogales or Juarez or something like that, and you went past the 60-kilometer line or whatever, you had to have a vehicle inspection and papers and all of that, it was kind of accepted that, well, back then $5, pretty much they didn't tear your car apart. Yeah. I remember when they cracked down. They had a crackdown on this in the early mid 80s. An anti-corruption thing because it was hampering tourism, and I had my $5 bill in my hand, and I was all ready to pop it, you know, discreetly in the hand of the El Coronel there. And when I popped out the money, I mean, oh my God, you thought I was. I mean, he skittered away from there, going, no, don't show that money to me. I can't take that.
Okay, well, let's get back to fishing here. So
let's get back to fishing.
So you mentioned quite a few species that you can target in the mangroves. How many are there approximately?
Said, we had a group, Rex Butler and company, caught 32. I would say our average number of species per group that we take out is 20-plus. A bit depends on the season. You know, we talked about the seasonality of that period, June and July. Now, when you get into October, this is when the snook come in. If you want to target the Pacific black snook, and they get big, mid-October all the way into December is an excellent time of year. So the primary species that we're looking at in the mangrove are going to be snook. When they're there, roosterfish. We've had some good sessions on roosterfish. And four different species of corvina, four different species of pargos, some snapper, broomtail grouper, the merro grouper, a fish that's called the quebra cuchillo, which is actually a leatherjack. They're found everywhere in there. Hard fighters, not much more than about 4 pounds. They will hit poppers. They do jump when you catch them. Jack revels, the pinnow bass are everywhere. The curicata is what they're called. A Cortez halibut are on the possible catch list. The Pacific bonefish is on the catch list. You just don't know cast to cast what you're going to catch. And then when you move out through the mouth of and into the Pacific, there is an area that from shoreline out to about 12 miles is a series of long rock ridges that are only 25 to 30 feet deep.
Let's talk about that next. Let's stick with the mangroves here for a few
minutes. Okay. In the mangrove, we can get roosterfish right at the mouths of where the water enters into the channels through the mouths of San Domingo, Soledad.
Are you fishing for those? That's not beach fishing like you do over on the East Cape, right?
Actually, right in the area of the mouth of Soledad, and we go up to San Domingo, quite often we will pull the boat up on the beach and fish from the beach and catch quite a few species actually from the beach. Quite often what we'll do is work that into our lunch hour. We're always mindful of tidal change, and we go where it's optimal in terms of either rising or falling water. But that makes for a nice, when it works out, it makes for a nice lunch stop area. But there's a few places inside the mangrove channels that we can pull the boat up on shore. People can kind of scatter out along and fish from the shore. Most of the fishing through the mangrove area is from the boat. And depending on where the tide is, whether it's flooding or falling, we'll either be fishing tight, casting tight right up against the mangrove, or will be backing off into the deeper channel water and fishing. Those fish will drop down from the mangrove, and they'll drop down into, oh my gosh, those channels are just choked with big mangrove log and all, and some rock, and those fish will be holding in, you know, 20, 25 feet of water. So we move back and forth between hugging the mangrove edge to fishing some of the channel water to going up into the flats. And there's a few places that when we're finding bonefish that will pull up on these extensive bars. And as they flood, the bonefish will come up on the bars, usually with a corvina at the same time and sometime the pargas, and we will wade and fish that. Now, this is not clear water like you're going to find in the caves in the Caribbean. It's not generally a situation where you're spotting fish and casting to them, especially on the bones. Water just is turbid enough that we don't often have that experience. What we are generally doing is casting at likely holding areas, you know, along the mangrove edge, trying to get in underneath the vegetation right next to the roots, or we're casting on fish boils. And we'll be looking for the different types of wading birds, the herons and all, the garces and the pelicans and all, that'll give us an idea, indication of surface feeding, and then we'll pull in on those areas and cast into the boils and that. Sometimes we're fishing poppers on the surface. Sometimes we're fishing weighted flies down deep on sinking lines. It just depends on where the fish are holding and feeding at the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, question from Derek in Richmond, B.C. He says, the channels look deep. Is this primarily boat fishing, or are there also weightable flats? So are there weightable flats, or are they weightable bars like you were talking about? Is that
they're really more bars that are extensive. But the bonefish definitely come in on them and take advantage of feeding on crabs and that sort of thing. You might be wading in knee-deep water as that water floods in on top. And there are times that you can actually see the fish themselves. More than likely what you're seeing is more water push from those fish. Like I said, the water clarity is not as clear as what you experience in the Caribbean. As far as depth in the channels, 30 foot is about the deepest that we encounter anywhere. If we're fishing the channels, we're generally fishing 17 to 20, 22 feet. So a 250, 300 grain line on an 8-weight, 9-weight generally will get you down to those fish.
That's what I was going to get to. Next, Dan in California, he says, talking about rods and lines, do you choose the weight of your rod mostly for the fish-fighting backbone required, or do you first consider the fly size and the casting distance as the main factor? Should I always err on the side of caution and carry my heaviest weight gear in Baja? So what do you really need in answer to his question, too? What do you need in the mangrove area to be prepared?
I'll tell you what, the mangrove area, we're not generally fishing large patterns, so you can cast an 8 or 9 weight is going to handle most of your conditions in the mangrove. Years ago, I used to, you know, go 10s and 12s because we'd catch the occasional large grouper, large snook, and they'd run us back into the mangrove roots or into the logs and break us off. You know what I found out? It didn't make any difference if you had an 8 weight or a 12 weight.
They still did it.
If you hook into a 30, 40-pound fish, you've got about as equal chance of landing him on an 8 or 9 weight as you do a 12 weight, to be honest with on it. You know, in either case, you're pointing the rod straight at the fish and hoping that the leader will hold before they find something to cut you off on. I have, in our previous shows and in my book and talking on the East Cape, I talk about, you know, don't bring a knife to a gunfight. And it does make a difference there when we're casting Arusha fish and big jack revels. We're casting big, bulky flies imitating mullet, and they're a 10 and 12 weight really are important to have to be able to push those big, bulky flies out there and handle 30 and maybe 40-pound fish. What we find in the mangrove here, the vast majority of the fish you're going to catch are going to be 5 pounds and under. and you can have a lot of fun with an 8-weight. You know, a nice combination would be an 8-weight with either an intermediate line or maybe in a floating line, and maybe a 9-weight, say, with a 250 or 300 grain sinking line to fish when we go deep. You can fish, in terms of flies, selection of clousers in size 4, 2, and maybe 1. And you're probably going to fish more 2s and 4s. Most of the bait fish is small. I fish a lot of white with a chartreuse top. Sometimes, based on water clarity, I'll go a little bit more towards, you know, tan, tannish yellow, maybe a little pink mint mixed in there. Probably 90% of what we're throwing is chartreuse over white in a fly that's, you know, an inch long. And a clouser minnow in the mangrove is going to catch. We have caught some of our biggest grouper on size 2 and size 4 clousers that are no more than an inch long.
Wow, yeah. Roy Fukushima in Orange, California, he says, what are my chances of landing a snook, as I was there a few times in early 2000 fishing the northern estuaries, and the gillnetters seem to have had decimated the snook population, although we did catch a variety of other species. So you had mentioned that the snook are back.
Has that
happened since 2000 then? Is that the time frame?
Oh, my gosh, yes. It used to be incredible. And the gillnetters basically hit a tipping point in the populations, and we saw that. Now, some significant things have happened. This area has been the Costa Salvaje group, which is part of Nature Conservancy, basically wrote up the proposal for marine biosphere protection. It was, everything was written in, regulations, everything was written in a year ago. We waited a year for the president to sign it into law. In the meantime, they did a moratorium on netting, that when you added in the fact that the winter time, nobody does anything but whales, the fall previous to that, everyone is shrimping. We had over a year without gill nets in there. This fall, there were days that the most common fish we caught was snook. We caught a lot of small juvenile snook that I have not seen since the 80s. Without the gill nets, we are seeing those juvenile snook, and we're seeing all size classes. We've seen a big resurgence of corvina. Corvina have always been there, but we were finding them kind of in a neat 18 to 22, 24, 26-inch range. And what we're seeing now is 8, 10-inchers, and we're seeing 32 and 34-inchers. Now, since then, the president of Mexico has signed into law the Vizcaíno Island, or Pacific Island Vizcaíno Desert Biosphere Protection, 2.6 million acres. And the primary focus is on protecting the mangroves, because that is where these fish reproduce and the nursery is. So there is no commercial fishing allowed in the mangrove.
Oh, yeah, even out
no
with hand nets line.
Offshore. Yeah, so that indiscriminate form of fishing now is gone. And we are already seeing the benefits of it. And, of course, we have seen the experiment that they did up in around Abreojos and Camporone, where it was actually the local cooperative that decided not to gill net in the mangrove, and the rebound of the fishery there. So in answer to his question, we saw a lot of snook this year. We had days where the clients were pushing 20 snook on the day. And a lot of them were smaller fish, but those are going to be bigger fish this coming year. And we're very excited about the prospect. They banned shrimp fishing from the Magdalena Bay all the way up to Abreojos, and that is a terribly indiscriminate way of commercial fishing, 80% bycatch. And out of there this year. And that is now a banned activity. So where we used to see 20 to 30 shrimp boats off of the mouth at Soledad, and we would see, you know, a mile or two of slick of dead juvenile snapper, triggerfish, and corvinas, and small groupers and all, that is now banned. So the future of this area is incredible. To Mexico's credit, 23% of their territorial waters are now protected in some level or other. They may allow, you know, hook and line fishing, like say for a grouper and snapper, but then again, that's a sustainable fishery. It's targeted to an individual species. You're not involving bycatch. That is permitted. So they are looking at ways to have both a sustainable commercial fishery and a very vibrant recreational fishery.
I know. We were seeing the same thing in Belize. They were, you know, that's protected water too, and they're hand line catching. And I went into a restaurant in Punta Gorda, and I couldn't believe the list of fish available in that restaurant. There must have been 15 varieties, from lionfish to snook to grouper, to snapper, just 15 different things. And they were all caught that day, you know, the previous night with hand lines just offshore. So it was a real treat, you know. It's sustainable and that the locals are making the money, and it's wonderful. So
exactly. You have to sustain the economies to be able to sustain recreational fishing, or then you begin to get outlaw fishing and that. And as long as they're hook and line, it remains sustainable. The problem is large purse seine fishing, large-scale drift net, large-scale long line. One of the things happening, and this has been on the part of several nonprofit organizations in Mexico, is getting the restaurants paired up with commercial fishermen to where that they are hook and line fishing, hand line fishing only. They will not buy anything that has gill net marks on it, and they want fresh fish. You set a gill net on a tidal change, you're looking at 12 hours that net is in the water. You may have fish that have been dead 8 to 10 hours in 80-degree water. Fish are almost worthless. To a restaurant.
Eric in Mendocino asked about bonefish. He says, I have caught what appear to be very small bonefish in Mag Bay. I have never seen one greater than a half a pound, nor have I sight-casted to them, which you've already explained why. Are these the same bonefish as found in tropical waters? I guess he's talking about like the Caribbean.
Sure. There are five subspecies of bonefish, and the Pacifics are the smallest of the subspecies, and they top out, a big one would be 4 pounds. And over the years, with all the commercial activity, gill netting, getting back to gill netting, they were not getting the opportunity to get much bigger than about 16 inches. So about half a pound is just exactly right. His observations are right on. What we have seen since the gill net have been prohibitive in the mangrove, we are seeing more bones over 20 inches. We got several that were around 3 pounds this past year. The size of the fish is coming up. Now, you're not going to see a double-digit bone in our waters. So the subspecies just does not get to that size.
Yeah.
But you can see fish that are over 20 inches now. And, you know, talking with the captains that we use when they're in their 50s down in their 30s, and they talk about 20 years ago or when they were kids, that they used to catch 3 and 4 pound bonefish quite commonly. I think with the gill nets out that we will start to see more of those larger fish. And we certainly saw it this last year. The average size bonefish this past year with the gill nets out almost a year now were decidedly larger than what we'd seen in the past.
Danny in Amarillo is asking about the whale watching, which Magdalena Bay is famous for. The question he has do they still allow that, and is that in an area where you're fishing? Can you do both that and whale watching at the same time, was another question we had.
Yeah, you can. We did that last year for the first time. We combined whale watching with fishing. So we do like maybe 2 hours of whale watching, And this area, it is an incredible area. The whales calve about the 25th, 26th, 27th of January. The first week or two, they're a little reluctant to bring the young whales close to the boats. They're a little bit shy. But as you get into February, and especially in March, then you have the opportunity to come right up. And actually, they seem to enjoy the human contact.
Is that up by you, where you're based out of? Or
oh, yes. Oh, yeah. It has become a big industry, and one of the good things about this for us in fly fishing, one, I think most fly fishermen enjoy the total things that is offered from an ecosystem rather than being focused on a species and catching fish. But what it has done is a couple things. One, it offers a unique experience and an opportunity to see what this ecosystem produces. The whale watching also provides local economies a very good line of revenue in primarily end of January, February, and into March. And we are combining whale watching with fishing. Now, the problem is there's so much demand on the captains and the boats during whale watching that that is the hardest thing, especially as you get into February and the first half of March. The best time to combine whale watching and fishing is mid-January to about mid-February. After that, the boats are pretty much everything is booked up well in advance on these whale watching tours. But that opportunity is there, and we're trying to develop that a little bit more. The captain family that we work with is actually trying to get more smaller boats rigged and outfitted for fishing to where that they can actually handle fly fishermen during the time of the whale season.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we're running out of time. We're going to have to move quick here. Let's talk about the inshore waters. You were beginning to describe those. So we get out of the mouth, out of the bay area, the estuaries and channels, and we're out into the Pacific. So briefly describe to us what species we're going to find out there and be fishing to.
Okay, I mentioned that there's a shelf that runs out about 12 miles, but we start hitting the first reef structure at about half a mile once we actually clear the mouth. And there we can get into broomtail grouper up to, well over 100 pounds. I remember one day we actually got four fly lines cut off from big grouper running us back into their caves. But 2 to 8, 10 pound grouper are very common. The, oh my gosh, there's such a variety of fish in the croaker and porgy class. The big oceanic triggerfish, which is becoming kind of a buzz out in, Christmas Island and even to the Seychelles, we get them 6, 8, 10 pounds, and they are a hard-fighting fish. Sheep's heads and tremendous variety of fish. We quite often will just, depending on the current, just shut off the engine, and we're fishing in 25 feet of water, sinking lines, and catching a large variety of fish. I mean, you're bent almost continuously on this. Now, in that same area and just beyond that, we start getting into our first encounters with Dorado, big Sierra mackerel, skipjack, and bonita. Every once in a while, we'll get a surprise in 30 feet of water and catch a yellowfin tuna. Now, moving out from those reefs, we start picking up Dorado at about 6, 7 miles and over structure. We can see big schools of Dorado in there. That's about the place that we start to see the first Wahoo, but definitely at about 12 miles, we were starting to get into about 200 feet of water. And again, a lot of structure that we work over. We use depth finders, fish finders to locate the structure and locate the bait fish if they're not evident to us. Quite often the birds will direct us to where the bait fish and the feeding predators are located. That area is hardly been tapped by fly fishermen, and some people are not as interested, you know, fishing sinking lines and that. Other people are just fascinated. You don't know what the heck you're going to catch next. I mean, it might be 2 to 4 pound fish, and then all of a sudden you've got a 40, 60, 80 pound grouper that just glummed onto the number two clouser and
right.
taking you into a cave. We've caught some big snook off of those same little pinnacles and ridges located
wow.
in that inch area. Oh, yeah. The variety of fish is incredible.
And then you move on out into the blue water?
Yeah. And the real crown is the what is referred to as the Pacific Ridge. And the Thetis Banks, the 23, the 28, this is what the charter boats have been coming down from San Diego for years. And these are the long-range boats that are basically you're looking at week-long trips. But back in the 90s, they were running trips with fly fishermen, and Trey Combs and Wendy and Terry Gunn and Abel and those folks were fishing this area and just breaking one line tackle record after another. When the fish migrate from going up towards California and come back down, it's starting in mid-October all the way through into December, the billfish, the yellowtail, the dorado, and the wahoo congregate over these offshore banks. It is a perfect alignment of the cold California current backed up against the warmer Donaldson current, a tremendous amount of upwelling and trapping of plankton that traps a variety of bait fish, and the tropical pelagics really congregate here. They set a record this year on striped marlin of 35 striped marlin caught by a single angler in a single day. They raised 80 marlin. This is on the 17th of October. They raised 80 marlin and released 35, including one sailfish. This year, after the El Nino, like we talked earlier, that warmer water, those fish were much more scattered going up into California. We didn't see the concentrations of fish. We had good fishing, but we didn't see the concentrations. This year, when we fished the Thetis, we would see schools of hundreds of marlin. We'd locate them seeing birds. We hardly ever pulled a teaser, hardly ever did a bait and switch on them. We would watch for birds, see the feeding activity, and come in on the boat, and in most cases shut the engine off, not just sitting there neutral. We shut the engine off and literally casting from the bow of the boat to striped marlin.
Wow.
It is an incredible experience. There's very few places in the world that you can get this type of fishing or you are casting to free-swimming marlin. And like I said a little earlier in the cast, there's so many dorado in the water, most people are ignoring the dorado, which I think is a shame.
Okay, so a couple quick answers to these questions. If a person wanted to experience all three of these fisheries, would that be possible, you know, on a week-long trip?
Oh, of course. What I recommend to people when they come to Lopez Mateos, if they're going to be there on a five-day trip, is to split up between the blue water, the near inshore, and the mangrove. There are three distinct fisheries, and fish them. There is a price difference because of the miles and the fuel costs to get out of the Thetis. But otherwise, no, I really recommend that people hit all three of those fisheries.
But given you've got decent weather for the 5 days, you can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Generally, you know, in the fall of the year, October into early the third week of November, weather in our local area is not a factor. This year what we ran into was swells coming down from storms really off the coast of Washington we had fairly flat seas offshore, but what we were getting was just enough swell coming into the mouth that we run out of, kept us inside. So what we do on our trips, I would say the average trip is 5 days of fishing, is maybe two or three offshore, the rest in mangrove. We just basically look at the conditions, and if it's not a good day to run the mouth, then we stay inside and we'll fish in the mangrove. The good thing about the mangrove, if our weather locally is bad, high winds and such, it doesn't affect us in the mangrove. We can find leeward tides. We just go into the channels. There was predominantly tall mangrove, and have a great day.
Yeah. Now, is and then what you talked about what we needed, you know, like maybe 8, 9 in the mangroves. What do you need for the inshore and the blue water? What size rods do you need to bring for that?
Now, if they fish with us, of course, we provide everything, flies and everything. That's all.
Oh, really?
In the price. Oh, yeah. Offshore, when you get into the billfish, you know, you're talking your 13, 14 weight, the billfish rods, in the TFO lineup, the blue water medium rod is perfect. A rod that we use quite a bit, you know, on the inshore reefs, I mean, a 12 weight works quite well. The Temple Fork blue water light duty rod is perfect. In the mangrove, an 8, 9 weight, and you know, maybe a 10, maybe a 12, as to if you're getting into larger fish and needing the backbone of a rod to pull them out of there. The blue water stuff is still, you know, dominated in that 12 to 14 rod weight area.
A lot of people don't have that, so but you've got it.
No,
so
that's no, cool. And that's why we do that.
Yeah.
We just incorporate it. If we're doing a blue water day, I generally put 4 to 5 rods per person on the boat. We may duplicate rod size, but you know, maybe one will have an intermediate line on it, and a rod in the same weight will put on a 400 grain sinking line if the fish are feeding a little bit deeper. Tuna quite often will come to the surface, but really we're catching them on the sink and on the drop. In fishing a sinking line, just for example. Or, because there's so many wahoo out there, we might have that same rod also rigged with 60-pound wire to prevent the bite-off. So mm-hmm. we always run a variety of rods and lines and leaders so that we don't have to spend any time changing from one to the other to take advantage of whatever feeding activity is taking place.
Sounds good, Mike. Sounds good. I'm excited. I'm ready to go. Of course, I'm always ready to go unless I'm writing an ambulance. But, terrific. Well, we're out of time. Stick with me here for a few more minutes, Mike. We're going to give away your book, Fly Fishing Baja and Beyond, and a couple other prizes here. So stay with me, folks. We'll be right back. Family Ties is an organization that uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website at www.familyties.com. That's family and then T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what do you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. Winners for our drawings are randomly selected from a show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late, but make sure you do so for our next show so you don't miss out on your chance at the incredible prizes we have to offer. So if you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and provide you with information on how to receive your prize. So first, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the International Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about the IFFF, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, and you'll learn all kinds of things about their conservation efforts. And, of course, they have the certified casting instruction, the certification for casting instructors, and it's just a great organization to be part of. So check them out. And let me get my database going here. And just a second. Be better organized here. Okay. Looks like we have Larry Eden. I guess it's Wyden. I'm sorry, Larry, I can't pronounce your last name. You know who you are, and looks like you've just got yourself a membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. So congratulations. Larry's in Colorado. And thanks for participating and playing. Our next prize is a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which you can learn more about at AmatoBooks.com. Check out all the other books and periodicals that Amato has to offer. They've got a wealth of books and periodicals that will help you with your fishing. Looks like we've got Eric Seal in Pennsylvania. So, Eric, congratulations, and I know you'll enjoy your subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. Now, I'm going to give away a copy of Mike's book, Mike's book, and Fly Fishing Baja and Beyond. And thanks to Mike for providing that book tonight. That will help even more about the Baja situation and the opportunities down there. So, and if you don't aren't the fortunate winner of that, Mike, is your book available on Amazon or through your website and so forth? Where's the best place to get it?
Oh, yeah. It's generally available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble and that. They can also get to it very easily from our website at BajaFlyFish.com. And there's a link on there. They can get a copy of the book generally within about 3 or 4 days. They can also get an electronic copy from
that. Okay.
Great. Yeah.
Great. BajaFlyFish.com. BajaFlyFish.com. And I know there was some question about rates and stuff. Be sure to check Mike's website about his rates and so forth, and or call him. Phone number's there. You can call him and chat with him about what's going on down there. So let's see here. Question, I hope I can phrase this right, but the one fish that's really coming on strong in the mangroves and the channels that is really having a good comeback and seems to be the most popular or the most fish caught in quantity nowadays, what fish is that? Go to our homepage, type in your answer to that on the text box there, and your name and location, and you'll win Mike's book. And we have, I think we have a winner. Mike, I've got an answer of Pacific Black Snook.
Yep, that's it.
Yeah, that would be the one, yeah. So Jake Jones, Yukon, Oklahoma. You are the winner. So you were fast and paying attention, and thanks for playing. So, Jake, you're going to have to, in that same text box, send me your address. I got your email address and your name. I need your mailing address so that Mike can get a book sent out to you. So thanks for paying attention and playing. We really appreciate you participating, and congrats on that. Well, Mike, hey, we really appreciate you being on with us again. Pleasure to talk with you. And thanks for sharing all your experiences with us. I know we could have talked for another 3 hours probably, but that makes for another show, right? Another day. So thanks again.
It does.
Well, it just, and you're out in California getting ready for a show?
Sacramento International Sportsman's Expo opens tomorrow morning, yes.
Yeah, okay, great, great. We'll have a good show, and thanks again for being on.
Thanks.
Our next broadcast will be February 1st, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and I'm going to be interviewing Devin Olson. Devin, I was supposed to interview when I had my accident, so he will be back on, and the topic will be tactical nymphing, Euro style. Devin is a medal-winning member of the Fly Fishing Team USA. He shares the modern-day nymphing techniques he and Lance Egan used, who was also on the team, to catch fish in the European style. And then when they're competing on an international basis like that, you've got to be good and you have to know how to adapt. So join us to find out how it's all done. We'd like to thank the International Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Tarpon Key Lodge, Watermaster, Keeney's Fly Shop for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, and everyone, and good fishing.